Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Denby, who's been a staff writer and film critic at The New Yorker since 1998. Before joining The New Yorker, he was the film critic for The New York Magazine for 20 years, and his writing also has appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Review of Books, and The New Republic. And in 1991, he received the National Magazine Award for his articles on high-end audio. His books include Awake in the Dark, an Anthology of Film Criticism, 1915 to the Present, American Sucker, and his latest book just out is Do the Movies Have a Future? Welcome to Background Briefing, David Denby.
Glad to be here.
And I normally cover national security and international relations, and but yet I'm across the street from Universal Studios speaking to you from our studio here in Los Angeles, and we are, of course, in a company town here. But in terms of just going back to national security and the Cold War, it's often been suggested that in many ways the Cold War ended not because of the number of nuclear weapons pointed at each other, but because of the United States' cultural hegemony, its soft power, as it's often referred to. And the movies have played a great part in that. If this is the case, how are we doing today in terms of our soft power, in terms of our movies being our ambassador around the world?
Well, the big movies, the major studio super budget pop spectacle movies, are made more and more for the world and less for America. Two-thirds of the box office comes from overseas, which has the effect of defoliating these movies of any particular American flavor. Local circumstances, complicated dialogue, psychology, and so on, which was very much part of our movies in the 70s. So our movies as cultural products are certainly playing all over the world more than ever. But they're not much about America. The digital stuff is sort of set everywhere and nowhere, and a lot of it is set in sort of the dead air of digital space where exacerbated pixels fight each other, and none of it really means very much. So certainly, it's a major American export, but whether people are getting the sense of the United States from these pictures, I doubt it.
So the notion is often expressed here in town with, if you go to any Starbucks, half the tables are taken up by wannabe screenwriters. So there's a lot of people out there in this town and in this business taking a crack at it. And the complaint one always hears is, they're not interested in movies about real things. They're only interested in making movies for 14-year-old boys. So is this to say then not only are we making films for 14-year-old boys, but we're making it sort of for a global homogenized version of the 14-year-old boy?
Yeah, 14 and up. Right. The they in that sentence means the big studios. I mean, the independent companies, some of them fairly large-sized, do make movies about real people and real things, but then you're not working at, large budget level. And I think a lot of writers have got to accustom themselves to that or have migrated to television if they want to do here and now real world stuff, because the subscription model at the cable networks, like HBO, support that stuff. Mom and Dad pay the bills for a monthly subscription, right? So David Simon, the creator of The Wire and Treme, came up to me and grabbed me by the lapels once and said, as long as I don't have to sell tickets, I'll be okay. By which he meant the HBO model that I write for works much better to do my kind of content than the movies that you're covering a lot of the time. I mean, the problem is that the blockbuster mentality has combined with the opening weekend bragging rights mentality. So a lot of movies are pitched to bring out the young audience that actually goes on opening weekend. I mean, people over 35, 40 tend to hold back until they've heard from their friends, or maybe they even follow a critic. Who knows? So if you're following, if this makes sense, people 15 to 25 exercise an influence on what gets made way out of proportion to their numbers in the population, even in the movie-going population. And grown-ups are essentially sort of treated like downsized workers the rest of the year, left to wander about aimlessly. I mean, it's not that there's nothing for them, but there's not a lot until this magical moment at the end of September when the audience IQ rises 40 points, and suddenly all the serious movies come out, and, you know, we have this 12-week season before the awards, and it happens this way every year. It's nuts. They're not cultivating grown-ups as an audience down the line. They're trying to capture 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 and 11-year-old kids with franchise entertainment based on comic books and digital spectacle, you know, and games and young adult novels, and then hold them forever with repeats. In other words, they've tied their future to the birth rate rather than creating movies for the entire audience. I think it's a terrible mistake. I even think it's a financial mistake. But that's the way it's been going ever since the conglomerates took over the big studios, and it just gets a little worse each year.
So is there a connection here then to the demise of family-owned newspapers and the newspaper business? The New York Times, of course, is held to a high standard. The LA Times used to be a family-owned business. It was a good newspaper. And then when it got corporatized and then the corporate raider came in, completely destroyed it. Is that the case that in the old days, in the golden age of Hollywood, they were individuals that ran the studios, they were family-owned companies? Now they're big corporations, and groups of vice presidents sit around these big tables and make decisions about greenlighting movies. And I imagine in a corporate culture, it's easy to greenlight a movie that has a lot of expensive pyrotechnics and wizardry in terms of special effects, because that's a kind of bottom line that you could see. You know, you spend $1 million on an explosion, you get $1 million worth of an explosion. Finding the values in terms of characters and nuance is a whole different thing.
Yeah, it's harder to sell to people who have to face quarterly, you know, reports to stock analysts who want to, you know, know what the revenue flow is going to be. It's not as if they weren't interested in money 60 or 70 years ago. It's always been a big money game. It would be naive to think anything else. But of course, they had less competition. There was nothing except newspapers and radio and bowling and fornication, I guess. There was not as much to do at night. Now, as everyone knows, the culture has disintegrated into a million different places. But as I say, they've chosen to put themselves in this box by making a certain kind of movie and schooling the audience to expect a certain kind of movie, and I think they're cutting off their future audiences. Instead of they're catching kids at, you know, at an early age with franchises and trying to hold them for 15 years. Movies were basically made for grown-ups until about 1975, 1980. I mean, there were family movies, of course, and Disney and animation and so on. But if you were a kid in the 50s and 60s, you got dragged by your parents and you half understood what was going on and you half didn't understand, and that was sort of laid the groundwork for grown-up taste in movies, and you know, you weren't expected to remain in a state of goofy euphoria forever. So it's in a way self-destructive, as well as destructive of, I think, the culture of movies and the language of movies. So many of these big movies, the way action is staged, you just don't remember a thing the next day. That nothing imprints itself except the busyness of digits contending in dead, you know, space. And so you wake up the next day and you have nothing in your head. That isn't good either.
But isn't that easier, in terms of creativity? That, you know, that's an easy, lazy shot to fire a gun, have a gun fight, or a car chase. It's so much more difficult to explore the violence in the human heart. I mean, isn't that...
Well, absolutely, and you know, maybe people will feel something. All of that's being pushed to the margins, to independent films, to this sort of Holocaust and tears and dysfunctional family season that you know, that we're in now. Actually, it's a little more public-spirited this year than usual. There's Argo, Ben Affleck's film about the hostage crisis. There's Lincoln, and so on. But normally, it's right. It's intense family dramas and or things like The Fighter. What you're talking about is held to this particular period, or it's migrated to television, and they've sort of given up on a lot of the older audience and let them let them go, which I think is a shame. I think they've broken the contract, the unspoken contract with the public, which the movie companies always felt they had to render something of the country's soul, something of its social relations, something of its streets, its parks, its interiors. That they've just given that up. Look, the old guys were Philistines in many ways. But they felt an obligation to bring what they thought was the best to the public. I mean, they were immigrants. They wanted to assimilate. They wanted respectability. They wanted to get into the country clubs and all of that. And they felt they had to bring the best to a large audience, that was their way in. The guys now just don't have, you know, they're college educated and business school educated, and they have none of those that sense of obligation. This book, by the way, is not all lamentation. There's a lot of it that's celebratory about what's good, and there's stuff on genres and like chick flicks and high school movies, and there's pieces about movie acting and so on. It's not, I don't want to seem like Dr. No here, and also I jump at any signs of life in the commercial movie culture, whatever it is, whether it's Ridley Scott's craftsmanship in Prometheus or Richard Gere giving a good performance in Arbitrage or Ben Affleck's thriller, as I mentioned before, Argo. Wherever there's life, critics have to go. I mean, and not be snobby about wherever it is. You go for it. And I'm particularly happy about, you know, pushing a small independent film like Beasts of the Southern Wild, because I think it's really magnificent. But if there's something good in a $150 million movie, I'm not going to turn my back on it.
Right. So you're not a liberal elitist.
Of course I'm a liberal elitist.
So are we talking about then the corporatization of our culture, and in this case multinational corporations sending this ubiquitous product around the world and blanketing the world in these quick hits that they do globally because of the problem with piracy? Now, Hannah Arendt once said that the rule by corporations is the rule by nobody, and it seems in many ways that we are in a kind of corporate plutocracy, if you will. Some people think our democracy is threatened by an emerging oligarchy. But is this to do then with the corporatization of our culture?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's happened in music. It's happened in many other places. Oh, there's always stuff that, you know, just as in music, you've got all kinds of renegade bands. And so now you can make movies very cheaply and sell them through the internet. I mean, it's not as if this is the only movies coming out, and they're small and medium-sized independent companies, although some of them have a lot of trouble getting their films into the theaters. Gaining traction in the theaters can be very, very hard. It's very expensive. Publicity is very expensive. Here's the killer. The theater chains don't necessarily want something like Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is an extraordinary movie that came out and cost exactly $1.3 million, came out last summer, and is at the moment the leading contender for the Oscar, unless Lincoln, you know, Spielberg's movie knocks it out of that spot. But anyway, they don't necessarily want an independent movie, because the whole theater business in the complex is about getting the maximum number of people to the concession stands. The ticket price cleans the toilet, keeps the lights on, keeps the projectors running. The money is made at the concession stand. So you're not going to give a shot to a movie which may do less well at a screen than Batman. You might add Batman to two screens, or three, or four, or five, however many it can bear. So it's about volume of bodies. So, I mean, it's very rough. It's not that that interesting movies aren't being made independently. They are. And if I can be self-important for a moment, the critics are often the ones standing between those movies and oblivion, because many of them do open and disappear. I mean, the New York Times reviews about 10 of them every Friday, and most of them don't get very far. So it's not a business model that's working very well, all in all. Now, the studios are putting so much money into these enormous films that if one of them really flops, the studio boss has to quit. That's not a sane business model, is it? This happened with John Carter earlier this year. And there are two ways out of this box, I think, that they've put themselves into. One is to make a slate of small winners. In other words, spend much less, go for a much smaller take. For instance, End of Watch, the cop movie that's out right now, which is quite good, with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena, was made for exactly $7 million, which by Hollywood standards is peanuts, and it's going to gross about 50 domestically and maybe the same overseas, and then all the ancillary markets will kick in. You could make 7 or 8 of those if you were a studio each year. They might not all be that good, but you could try. That's one way. The other way, which Steven Soderbergh, the writer-director, has been pushing for years, is to cut way down on upfront costs. In other words, don't pay stars $10 million or $12. Pay them what is a reasonable amount, I mean a moderate amount, rather, by Hollywood standards, like $1 million, and pay the director $750,000 and so on. And then divide everything by fixed percentages at the back end as all the revenue comes in perpetuity. Continue dividing it. And obviously the financing people would get the most since they put up the money, but the star would get his 3% forever and the director would get his 2% forever and so on. And by bringing down initial costs by 30 or 40%, Soderbergh believed, the studio boss could make more interesting choices. He wouldn't be quite so dominated by the marketing people. You know, he might, for heaven's sakes, actually put his own taste into operation. So, I mean, there are ways out of this box. They just don't want to do it.
Again, I'm speaking with David Denby, a film critic at The New Yorker, and his new book just out is Do the Movies Have a Future? So just in terms of going back to the idea of the U.S. being the kind of global cultural hegemon, what do you think is this perennial, now that we're in a political season? The Republicans have a particular dislike for Hollywood. It's a pejorative, and I'm curious to know why it is that in terms of politics, it seems that the talent is on the left, at least supporting, not that the Democrats are that far on the left, but they tend to support the Democrats, whereas the conservatives are the ones that are railing against Hollywood. The woman that's going to be not debated tomorrow night in the vice presidential debate, but apparently Ayn Rand had an influence over the vice presidential nominee on the Republican side, Paul Ryan.
Sure.
She was basically a bitter failed Hollywood screenwriter, wasn't she?
Philosophical novelist.
Right, but she helped gin up the House of Un-American Activities, which is still an open wound here in this town.
Well, Hollywood has generally been liberal, in part because it's a popular medium, and you know what was the people's medium, the art form for everyone. So there were a lot of populist themed movies in the 30s and anti-fascist movies in the 40s, particularly from Warner Brothers. And I mean, it's not that they weren't right-wing figures like John Wayne and to some degree James Stewart, although they made all kinds of movies. But it's generally been a liberal community just by the nature of the business and who and how large an audience they have to appeal to. So I don't think there's anything surprising about that. It's almost functional in a way. I think the Republican attitude towards Hollywood is a non-starter. It's stupid, and I mean, they should stop it.
Well, but there's no symmetry between the kind of money that a few celebrities give and the kind of money that under Citizens United that a big corporation can
give. Absolutely not. Right. No, the big corporations, we are becoming a plutocracy in this election. And there are right-wing plutocrats who are putting money to make political movies. This film, which was a complete flop, won't step back, won't stand back, whatever it was called.
Oh, about
won't
the teachers.
Back down.
Yeah, yeah.
About the parent trigger law, that is parents and teachers taking over a school. It's an anti-union movie. The money for that was put up by Philip Anschutz, who also made Waiting for Superman. which was a very misleading documentary about how great charter schools and how dreadful the public school system is. So Anschutz is, you know, putting his money into movies that push a right-wing agenda.
Well, didn't that film that was out recently by Dinesh D'Souza, which was a hit job against Obama,
that was a big hit.
That did well, didn't it?
Yes, I didn't see it, but it did very well for a documentary, well over $20 million. And I've met Dinesh D'Souza, and I would describe him as unreliable in his views.
Well, that's a very polite way of putting it.
Polite as I can be.
Again, I'm speaking with David Denby, who's the film critic for The New Yorker. He's the author of the new book just out, Do the Movies Have a Future? So just to stay with documentaries for a minute, my sense is that the reason we're seeing so many documentaries is that the news business, which has been corporatized, I mentioned that before about the family ownership of the New York Times vis-a-vis the corporate takeover of the LA Times and its subsequent demise, I suspect that a lot of the reason why we have so many politically themed feature documentaries out is that the big news organizations are closing down their investigative bureaus because they're too expensive and all they do is invite lawsuits, and the legal department basically hates the investigative department.
Yeah.
And so is that what's going on here?
I think you're right. I think let me be low-minded also, that documentaries have become much cheaper to make since the invention of digital technology, because when I was a film student 45 years ago, I mean, if you were going to make anything except a film about the local sewerage problems, you had to get the money from your parents, and it was a lot of money to make even a half-an-hour film. So if you can just get out there, you know, in the streets or do your investigative reporting with a lightweight digital camera, not print anything, and edit on a computer, it brings the costs way down. This should be a great period for documentary. This is a politically exciting time and a dangerous time. I mean, and I like Inside Job, Charles Ferguson's movie, very much. I like him more than Michael Moore, whose shtick I think I've gotten tired of about three movies ago. So, and then there are veterans like Frederick Wiseman who have been doing them for years, who were very good. I think, and a lot of it's made for public television, and it plays at film festivals, which, by the way, film festivals in every city, which I used to make fun of, have become a transmission point for a lot of interesting movies, foreign films, documentaries, and independent American movies, because people can't see them at the mall. So they have to go to these film festivals, and they are happy to go to them. It's one of the things that's keeping the independent cinema going, is this, you know, a film city in every town in the country, virtually.
Well, David Denby, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Do the Movies Have a Future?
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Denby. He's been a staff writer and film critic at The New Yorker since 1998. Before joining The New Yorker, he was a film critic for The New York Magazine for 20 years. His writings also appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Review of Books, and The New Republic. And in 1991, he received the National Magazine Award for his articles on high-end audio. His books include Awake in the Dark, an anthology of film criticism, 1915 to the present, and American Sucker. And his latest book just out is Do the Movies Have a Future? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.